Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Rogue Startups. Today, I have my good friend Steve McLeod on the show. Steve, how's it going?
I'm going well. Thanks, Craig.
Awesome. So, Steve, many folks that listen to this podcast may also know you from the Bootstrap podcast. Do you want to kind of give a plug and a bit of an intro of what that's all about for folks who aren't listening currently?
Sure. The Bootstrap podcast is something I actually inherited. It was started a few years ago by Ian Lansman and Andrei Butov. After a few years, they wanted to concentrate on their core project, so they gave me the chance to start a new iteration of it, which I've been doing for about a year. Episodes are weekly, almost weekly, and we cover themes that are important for people trying to bootstrap a software product or who are currently bootstrapping a software product, whether it be B2B, SaaS, or desktop products, or even like info products.
Cool. Yeah, I would say that, you know, folks that listen to this show would find a lot of kind of similarities and overlap with the things that y'all talk about there. And I know you have frequent co-hosts, and Ed Freifogel, former guest on this podcast and kind of friend of ours, has been on there a bunch. So I think it's cool for you guys to kind of have that running thread of kind of things that y'all talk about and kind of follow your journey there. So yeah, it's a really good show.
Thank you. I really enjoy doing it.
So I think, you know, Steve, we have been talking, well, for a long time. We've known each other for a few years now. And I think one interesting thing that we want to talk about today that I would suppose you get a lot of questions about, I certainly do, is what is it like to live in another country? What is it like to be a full-time kind of permanent expat, right? And I think we're going to be really honest. I hope we're really honest here. And it's not all great and it's not all terrible, but I think hopefully we can kind of shed some light on stuff that folks don't talk about. You haven't seen in blog posts about kind of what it's really like to live in another country. But maybe if Steve, kind of begin with kind of like maybe share with folks where you're from and where you're currently living and what that whole kind of situation looks like.
Sure. So I'm from New Zealand, but partly grew up in Australia too. So that means to New Zealanders, I sound Australian, and to Australians, I sound New Zealandish, like a New Zealander. I'm currently living in Barcelona, Spain, and I've been here for 8 years. The reasons I came here are long and varied, but I am here and it's a wonderful place to live most of the time. It's an interesting place to run a business. And when I say interesting, I mean difficult. But you don't move to Spain for ease of running business. Yeah. The life I'm living here is very much not the digital nomad type that I think a lot of people think these days when you talk about living abroad. You know, where they're living in a very much a bubble in Thailand or Bali. Very much living the life of a regular person in Spain.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to differentiate because, yeah, I mean, there is that like digital nomad, you know, Tropical MBA Dynamite Circle kind of group that is fantastic. And we did that for a few months. I think right after I quit my job, we traveled Europe for 2.5 months and it's exhausting. I would never, ever, ever do it again. I mean, we have kids. I know you have a young daughter too. And yeah, we very much try to live like locals. Like we live in a small village just outside of Annecy. And we have a lot of local friends and try to live like, you know, local French folks do. But I definitely can appreciate the difficulty of running a business, I think in Europe, right? I mean, France, Spain, the Netherlands, even the UK, probably to maybe a little bit lesser extent, is just hard. I mean, I'll say a couple of things that come to mind when you say running a business in Europe, and maybe you can add another handful to this, but the first is bookkeeping. And I don't mean accounting like taxes you have to pay. I mean bookkeeping. I just talked to Dave for Rogue Startups yesterday, and he was going to get a bookkeeper. And I was like, wow, just use Bench.co. It's like almost 100% entirely automated. They hook into Stripe. They hook into my bank account. They hook into PayPal. All of this stuff happens automatically. They send me one email a month and say, hey, can you help us categorize these two or three expenses? I go in, they have like this automated like checklist thing. I say, this is this, and this is this, and this and this. None of that exists in France. The concept of a bookkeeper doesn't exist. If you ask somebody for like a P&L or a balance sheet, they say, that's your job. And so I just like, it just blows my mind that like that concept doesn't exist. I mean, this is a this is a first world country. Like this is, mm-hmm. this is not some undeveloped. And so anyway, that for me, as far as running a business, that is the hardest thing. And all of the tax and insurance stuff and just complexity of paperwork that goes along with that is kind of in the similar vein. So I don't know. I'm sure that rings true to you because you're nodding a lot. But is there anything else that, like, when you say running a business in Spain is not easy,
Does it look like I'm nodding? I'm crying. I'm trying to hold back the tears. What was this app you mentioned where for American companies it just does everything? I can't believe it. Ah, I have a cure for that. We can't use the famous international bookkeeping software like Xero and so on because it just doesn't work in Spain with the Spanish laws. For exactly what you describe, everything here is hard. Yeah, I don't know how that came to be, but all the bookkeeping stuff is difficult. The really strange laws, which I still haven't got my head around after 8 years, and we do have a professional. We use a guest store, as they call them here in Spain. She runs a little company and helps businesses like mine, and without her, we would be drowning. And she's always asking me to sign some form or, you know, do something on the some type of bank transfer to the taxation department again, and I actually don't understand much of it. And I have to say, I don't have a clear idea of just how profitable my business is, and it kind of disturbs me. Yeah. All I know is that most years there's more money in the bank account than there was at the beginning. Yeah, that's really painful. And I don't know how much of that is because it is objectively difficult here, or is it because I just don't have the right mentality, not having grown up in Spain, and I don't understand these things. I expect them to be the way they were in my home country, which, of course, they're not. So maybe I'm the problem. Maybe Spain's actually got a really good system. No, it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like, Steve, how would you categorize your Spanish level? Because I think that's a big part of a lot of this.
How family friendly is this podcast?
Extremely, or extremely not. So you feel free to be honest.
My Spanish has a lot of room to improve. I can read things and newspaper articles and so on, but I can't engage in casual conversations beyond, you know, talking about the weather or the sports. Yeah. So there's a lot of room for improvement.
Yeah, I would say my French is similar. I can talk to, you know, our kids' friends' parents and talk to people at the store, but our accountant speaks English, which is great.
Wow.
I would totally be lost otherwise. Yeah, and trying to do business in French and for you Spanish would probably be really difficult. And I think that, like, I think we're going to talk mostly about bad things in this podcast because I think like you mentioned before we started recording, like, everybody sees, like, on Instagram, the pictures at the beach in October and it's beautiful, or the pictures of going skiing in the Alps, which are 30 minutes away. And all of that stuff is really obvious, I think. But maybe, you know, I think, like, Dave and I talk, we have a responsibility to be honest about the downside of a lot of things. And I think that's a lot of why you and I wanted to have this conversation.
How do you make friends? Like, if your French is not very good, and I guess your neighbors generally don't have a great level of English or are not comfortable speaking it.
Yep.
This is what you don't think about before you move to another country where the language is not what you learn. How do you make friends in this situation? And it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. So almost all of our friends are parents of our kids' friends. So we live in a small town. Each of our kids, like, school classes is like 20 kids. And so they each have a handful of little friends, and our friends are their parents.
Are they French?
And so, oh yeah, yep.
Great.
And most of them speak some level of English because we live in a pretty international area with Geneva being like 20 minutes away. So a lot of people go to Geneva and work to some extent in English.
Uh-huh.
But we speak French with them all the time.
Uh-huh. It's something you don't think about. Well, I certainly didn't think about is that how hard it would be to actually get into local circles until you have a really good level of the language. But the best way to get a good level of the language is to actually immerse yourself in the culture and make local friends. My saving grace was people who live locally, are from local, but have lived abroad, and now they've come back home. They kind of want to maintain international life to some degree, even if it's like through other people, and they want to practice their English and so on. That was my way of making local friends.
Yeah, yeah. And your partner is Spanish?
She's Italian.
She's Italian.
She speaks all the languages fluently, which is really frustrating to watch somebody who can do that.
Okay.
We went for a trip to Brazil a few years ago, and in the 1 month we were there, she went from speaking beginner level of Portuguese to being able to have conversations with taxi drivers on political things. And that was so frustrating
to
watch.
It's amazing. Yeah.
It's also very useful to have in a partner.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that just comes from you almost only see that people who grow up in Europe and, grow up Italian or Spanish and learn French and Spanish and Portuguese and all this kind of stuff, because like in the US or even here, our kids are obviously fluent in English, but like in school, they're only learning like today is Tuesday, it is sunny. And my daughter is 10, you know? Uh-huh. And so like her kids in her class can't count to 10 in English. And like that is such a shame compared to other like Northern European countries, like the Netherlands and Sweden and stuff, that, I mean, they're full-time English learning from a very young age. I think the difference there is probably that like Spanish or French or Italian or those countries are so big that you can get by, or up until now, you could have gotten by without learning English and working in another language, because you can just kind of live in your bubble. But you know, the Netherlands is such a small place that you can't just know Dutch and think you can get by. So they have to learn a language. But I don't know. I think the language thing, like to get to the point maybe where we're at, where it's like, I can go to a restaurant and order a coffee, I can get in a taxi and tell them where I want to go, is great. But then that like that next level is a huge jump in learning and, you know, fluency. I do think that is, I don't know, maybe the thing that's holding us back, right? Of feeling super comfortable where we are.
Okay. So do you feel like you are part of the community, or you feel you're an outsider?
Both, I guess. And this really chaps my ass. Like, I think our friends have pity on us, you know, I mean, just think about it. Like you go to a party or a coffee shop or something, and there's someone there that doesn't speak great English. You would take the extra time to talk to them and want to help them and stuff. But if it's every day, eventually they're going to be like, come on, just learn, right? Or don't, and go away.
And like you could learn, but it's a big commitment of time, and you've got a business to run and a family tend to, and I hope like maybe some health interests and whatever. And it's actually quite hard to find the time and to prioritize that. I am in that kind of battle myself, and I want to spend more time learning Spanish, but not at the cost of my business. My business gets my best energy at the moment.
Yeah, your business is, right? So I guess we should take a step back and talk about kind of what you do. And you have two businesses now, right?
Yeah. That's pretty foolish, huh? One's tough, two's tougher. Yeah, I have why can't I think of what my products are? Feature Up Food. I've been running that for 3.5 years. This is a forum in which your customers can suggest and upvote improvements to your product. The other one is Sabre Feedback, which I actually acquired a few months ago, so I haven't built it from scratch. And this one is a feedback button you can add to any website. So it's a kind of synergy between the two products, although they don't integrate yet. Feature Upvote's growing quite well. Every month we have more customers than the month before, and it's been like that since we started. Sabre Feedback, the one I acquired, is in a plateau, and it was before I took it over, and my battle at the moment is growing that and getting it out of the slump.
And what does your team look like? I assume you have like a shared team that works across both apps. Is that right?
Exactly. I was surprised today to see that we're 6 people. I thought we were 5, and then Slack told me that we have 6 users, and I counted, and that's right. I guess I was trying to count in Spanish and not in English. And they're all part-time. So we have a... you know what? We are 5. I just realized we are, because one person had to stop working because of family situation for a few months. Yes, we are 5 currently. We have a content person, we have a web developer, system admin, a general person who does a lot of everything. That's my girlfriend and me. And we just got a designer to start last month to start whipping our products into shape. making them look better and more usable.
Yeah.
Everybody works part-time, so we're much, much smaller than we sound from that.
For your designer, I'd love to, we have a designer that we work with part-time on kind of project basis, but I'd love to hear how you work with your designer, because I think for us, it's made a huge difference. I'd love to hear how you guys work together on the apps.
Okay, it's still quite new, and I think we're still working out exactly how to do that. It's just a month now since he started working, and I've given him one part of feature upvote, the dashboard that only actual admins and moderators see, and I've asked him to do an audit of that, and he identified some problems, and he's then suggested a being more consistent and being more modern, and has done mock-ups in some tool called Figma. Are you familiar with Figma?
Yep. Yeah, that's what our designer uses too. Yep.
Okay, it must be what designers like to use these days. He introduced it to me, and then now he's just started the process of liaising with our web guy to start turning that into a reality. And I'm actually really excited about it and kind of impatient, and I want to keep asking them both, so show me what you've done now, show me what you've done now. And I know that's not the right way to manage people, so I'm trying to back off.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, five people is at kind of a similar place that we are. How do you manage them, especially kind of being part time? I would guess that would make it even more difficult, because you I suppose like have days where they're working with you and days where they're not. What is your general kind of organization and kind of team workflow like?
So we use the typical tools like Slack and email and Jira and GitHub, and we communicate a lot through that. At the moment, everything goes through me, for better or worse. Mm. I'm kind of the hub through which everything goes, and perhaps that's something I need to work on in the year or two ahead. Although maybe not, maybe at this size it's the right way. Who knows? I try to communicate a lot, repeating the same things over and over again, just to make sure that there's a shared mentality of how our product should work and how our approach should be. And that actually helps more than I realized. Just keep saying over and over again, keep the product simple, keep the process simple, make it so that the customer doesn't need to think. And, you know, if I say that once or twice, it doesn't get through. But after I've said it every month for a year, people start telling me off when I'm breaking that rule. And then I know it's getting through.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's cool. I really appreciate that last part of when we've done a good job of kind of instilling these things in our team and we break our own rules, they come back and say, you can't, you know, for me, it's you can't interrupt a dev cycle when you want a thing. You can't just tell me to stop working on this thing and go over and work on this thing. Or on the marketing side, you know, you can't just come up with some crazy idea and assume that we can just do it and spend a month working on this thing. So I think it's cool. And it's a sign that I think our teams have responsibility and ownership over kind of what they're doing, which is, I think, really hard and like the sign of a really mature team. So that's cool. That's cool to hear.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Just hearing what you said made me think about to what degree I can just trust somebody to do a good job and what degree I need to manage and guide. And I don't think I've quite worked out exactly when to transition from hand-holding to saying, okay, I trust you, go and do your best and just show me the finished product. What about you? To what degree do you just get out of the way and let people do their work?
Yeah, I think it depends on kind of what area of the business and how much I have done the work ahead of time to be really clear about that. And I think that's where like we all fall down a little bit, is if we just fire off a one-liner in Slack to say, you know, go build this thing, or can we integrate with Zapier? That is not setting them up for success if we just leave them to be and do it however they want. But if you're, for me at least, if I'm able to like have a call or put together a Notion doc that outlines exactly the kind of marketing thing I want to do or the kind of product I want to build or feature or whatever, that I feel more comfortable with kind of letting somebody be, because I mean, history has shown, at least for us, that like if I do that work and I'm really clear, they have a better chance of being successful. And so that's kind of where I stand on things. And if I had to guess how much of the time that is these days, maybe it's like 70% of the time. And the rest of the 30% is kind of this iterative process where I fire off a one-liner in Slack, somebody comes back a day later and says, hey, this is the thing. I say, yep, that is right. but this is not, let's go tweak this one part of things over here. I don't know, what's the percentage for you?
Well, that actually aspect there is something I'm struggling with. Actually telling a professional that actually what they did is not the way I want it to be. And to say that in a way that's respectful and not going to discourage them. I don't want to be that boss who just keeps thinking he knows better about everything. And I maybe hear too much the other side and think, well, I'll just let them do what they want to do because I don't want to tell them. And actually, I think sometimes I do need to be the firm hand. So I haven't come to terms with how to do that properly.
Yeah. I think the danger there, and I don't do a great job of this either, but the danger there is if you're not clear with people and like really honest, like proactively honest, that's not the right word. Like this book, Radical Candor. Have you read this book?
No, but I like the phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. So it talks a lot about this, that like being aggressively open is not the right term, but like radically candor, like being really, really honest and open and objective with people is actually really good for them. Okay. And really good for their ability to be successful and stuff. And so I don't do a great job of this, but I try very hard to do more of this and be consistent with it. Because I do think that like if we're as like business owners and leaders, if we're not communicating consistently and really openly with people, this is what I was getting at. It's like it festers over time, right? So if your developer does things 10% wrong all the time, you're going to think, this guy is a piece of shit. Like he can never build the right stuff. When, if you're honest, it's probably mostly your fault or my fault.
Right, right.
Because I did not give the right stuff at first. And then when they came back with the first version and said, yeah, that, but I want a little more of this, or make the button red or whatever. Because they're not bad people, right? Like,
I hope not.
And they care a lot about ours. I mean, I think care a lot about what we're doing and being successful. But it is a super hard like interpersonal thing to give professionals, especially ones that are above where you are in a certain discipline, constructive criticism and feedback about like, hey, yeah, that's just not what I want. That's super hard. Yeah.
So I have a specific story to tell about on that theme. The web developer and content person I have worked very closely together for 2 or 3 years, first on Feature Upvote, and then starting in April this year on Sabre Feedback. And I worked very closely with them in the first year or so, really guiding and being almost difficult. But with Sabre Feedback, they by now knew the way I liked things. Also, because of COVID and I was stuck for a few months in Australia in a different time zone, I wasn't able to work with them closely like I would have. So I just basically had to say, look, you know how we did Feature Upvote. I want you to concentrate now on Sabre Feedback, but just SEO. For now, we just need to fix up SEO. I know there's other things you want to do and that need being fixed, but please just concentrate on SEO. And I kept repeating that, but that was it. Then I just let them go do their thing. And now 6 months later, I look at the work they achieved and it's pretty much exactly what I wanted.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't find that, I think, with a team from day one. It takes a long time to get to where everybody has this common idea of how things should be. And I'm just ecstatically pleased with how that went.
That's cool. Do you think it's mostly that you did it before and you're trying to just kind of run the same playbook but on a different business the second time?
To some degree, that is the case, except the playbook's not written. Somehow it was just in the atmosphere of our team. Mm-hmm. It should be written, I think. That would be sensible of me. But I'm kind of allergic to writing down processes. It's another thing I'm trying to fix, but...
I mean, I think that's the next phase, right? Is so we're 7 people, we'll be 8 next month. And
are they all full time, Craig?
Yeah, 7 full time people. Yeah.
Wow.
But that's the next step, is to be able to hire somebody and them come in and be productive from day one.
Oh, that would be nice.
Because, I mean, what you're talking about is like onboarding, right? Of your team took, you know, a year. And I'm the same way, right? Denise, our marketing lead for Castos, joined and we had hour-long calls twice a week just talking about how we do stuff and how I think about marketing and how she thinks about it. I mean, she has a ton of experience that in a lot of ways is much more rich than mine. And so how do we kind of formulate this plan and we pivot and all this kind of stuff? And so now, like, we just hired a success person. And that ramp up time was quicker, but he's 2 months in now and still kind of getting his feet wet in certain aspects. So like,
yeah,
but I think if you look at, oh, I don't know, like a team that's 15 or 20 people, you know, like Cart Hook, maybe, you know, Jordan Gall, I think they can probably hire somebody and that person comes in, has like a mentor, has a bunch of written processes. They know how to get up to speed, a developer or a person in customer service probably gets up to speed in the first month. But that just seems like a mountain. Like there's a mountain of organization and documentation and stuff that I'm also allergic to. Yeah.
So why did you start your business? Is it because you wanted the right processes or did you start it because you actually enjoyed podcasting? Like, do you have an answer? Do you think about that?
So I think the real reason that Castos exists now is I saw an opportunity, right? So the story is like this WordPress plugin, Seriously Simple Podcasting, that we own. The person that wrote it originally was going to work for Automattic and wanted to kind of offload this to somebody else. And kind of already being in the podcasting space, actually one of our Podcast Motor customers came and said, hey, you know, this guy, Hugh Lashbrook, is selling this plugin. I think this is an interesting space for you guys to get into software if you want to check it out. And so I looked at it and said, wow, this is exactly basically what Blueberry and PowerPress do. But they just don't, you know, Seriously Simple Podcasting exists, but the hosting arm doesn't. And really in the podcasting space, hosting at that time, now there's tools like Squadcast that I think are other viable kind of business opportunities. But hosting is the only viable for me kind of business model in podcasting. There's just not a lot of different types of businesses. So just kind of it was an opportunity and made some sense. And yeah, here we are. I know you were much more intentional about like kind of lifestyle design and like if I build a business, it has to be this like 4-hour work week potential kind of thing, right?
Yeah, or well, maybe 4-hour work day rather than a 4-hour work week.
That's still pretty good.
You know, things have changed for a couple of reasons. One is my daughter being born last year made me think more about what I want to get out of the business. But as it keeps growing, especially on feature upvote side of things, I realize that the business has far more potential than I ever imagined when it started. If it keeps growing the way it does, then it could become quite a serious operation. And I'm still in that battle of whether I want to keep my life very relaxed work-wise or whether I want to really do the best I possibly could with it. And I'm still like torn between that.
Do you think that it's a one way or the other, like a binary decision? Do you think that you can kind of have a lifestyle business and still get everything, you know, take the business to its maximal opportunity? Do you think those things can exist at the same time?
Yeah, they can. Actually, now you ask. I like that. You've just triggered off a third path in my mind. They can. And actually, I've discovered that with what I did with Sabre Feedback, where I said that I put my web guy and my content person loose on it, sometimes I realized I just did nothing to do with that all day. And I felt like maybe I'm supposed to be busier running a business. Why is it that I have still enough time to go for a bike ride or to take my daughter to the zoo? So, yeah, this mentality I also have to fight, which is just it's okay to not be doing very much and let other people do the work for you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, we look at like our mutual friend Carlos from Quaderno.
Yeah.
I mean, they are a hugely successful company. Carlos and I are in a mastermind together, so I have to be careful how much I talk about on the podcast. But I mean, I think it's pretty like it's in their job descriptions that they work 5 hours a day, and they are 100% growing. They are very successful. They could get acquired for, you know, 8 figures, I'm sure. And I think he's just taking this approach that like I'm going to put 5 good hours in, and then I'm going to stop, and it'll be there tomorrow, right? And I think that's the thing that for me like. I don't know. Like, I haven't talked about this much, but like we joined Tiny Seed and I have this attitude that like our business is super important and that we have to have like the pedal to the metal all the time. And I think part of that is my own ego thinking that like I or my business are really important, you know? And maybe they are, and maybe there's really something and I should I do have a lot of respect, but maybe I also can just say, man, if we just like live a little and like have a little better life work balance, the business probably will still do about the same. And I will be more comfortable doing this for 20 years than than the other option, which I think is do this really good and go hard for 5 years and get everything you can out of it. I think like some people we know in this world have done that, and it takes a toll mentally and physically. And then you still have to go do something afterwards anyhow. You know, you're very few of us are just going to go sit on a beach for the rest of our lives. So I'm getting more comfortable. Yeah. I mean, I'm getting more comfortable with saying like, yeah, that middle road of like, we can be a successful, growing, impactful, even high growth business, but I want to work 35 hours a week.
And but though, as a business
that should
owner,
be possible.
As a business owner, even if you're not physically working, aren't you always just thinking over things all the time, no matter what you're doing? The inability to switch off is a bit of a pain. And I think that's why I could never just like work hard for 5 years, sell, and then be done. It's like I'd have this big emptiness of the time.
Getting back to kind of living in another place, like talked about work and like owning a business and taxes and things like that. Are there other parts of that, like from a work perspective or not, that you find challenging or that was surprising that you don't hear other folks talking about?
What I found specifically about Spain, this probably doesn't apply to other countries, is that people's mentality is more about enjoying life than about making the most of work. And that really has been difficult for me, that people think if you're meeting for business at 10 o'clock, it's okay to turn up at 10:15. To me, that's completely not okay, and it shows disrespect. But not in Spain. This is actually what both sides normally expect. This has been really tough, that I've come in with one type of mindset. It's very much part of my own country, my own culture. We're the type of place where we just go and do what we have to do, roll up our sleeves, get it done, then leave. Whereas in Spain, it's, well, look, in the case it sounds like I'm insulting the country, I will say it has one of the highest happiest levels in Europe. It has the longest life expectancy in Europe. They're happy, they're healthy, they have a lot of fun. So I think maybe they're doing it right. And that's something that's very challenging for me, even now after 8 years.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a lot of that has rubbed off on me. And maybe talking about this kind of balanced attitude I have towards work and like the path that we're on lately is some of that. Whereas like, I mean, in the States, there's much less, it's a big place, right? And there's a lot of different people, but there's much less concept of like work-life balance and yeah, it'll all work itself out and stuff. And I think, yeah, Spain, France, most of kind of Mediterranean Europe is similar. Do you miss New Zealand? Do you, like, I know you went back and like, do you miss it? Do you sometimes, and in some ways, right? Because I think it's not just a yes or no, but like in some ways, do you wish you moved back?
Not really, but kind of. In the international yearly ranks of ease of doing business, New Zealand is either number one or number two year after year. And I look at that and think, here I am in Spain where it's so difficult. And if I went back to my own country, things would be so much easier. I even have talked to a relative of mine who's an accountant about whether it would be easy to move the business there while I stay here. And he said, no. As soon as you do that, you're living in one country and running in another. Life is difficult. So business-wise, yes. Lifestyle-wise, no. I think my country's really beautiful and I always love visiting it and I'm always happy to leave again. And that's because it's islands in the Pacific, 2,000 kilometers from the next closest country. You know, there's no sense of an international community. It's a really literally insular place. So that I don't miss. And there's no chance of me moving there in the near future. Maybe one day, depending on family situations, but was certainly nothing that's on the cards at all. What about you moving back to the States? Is that something you'd ever do?
If I had to, I would. I think probably like you, it's there are many, many, many worse places to move to. You know, I think the U.S. is a big old mess right now, but objectively, like, you know, how much does Donald Trump affect my life? Not much, right? Like, I could go back and live in a little bubble where we have a bunch of friends that think like we do, and I'm sure it would be fine. It would be very sad. But yeah, I mean, I miss very few things on a regular basis. College football just started, and being from Florida, like, that's, and living in the Southeast most of my life, that's a really fun time. It's just really fun. Like, Saturday college football and tailgating and all this kind of stuff is just a lot of fun. And that this doesn't exist here. But I mean, it doesn't exist this year really in the States either. Like, there's no fans at the game. So yeah, I mean, some little things like that, I miss. I think that the thing that really pulls at me sometimes, and you can probably relate, is like that depth of connection that I miss with people here, or I'm missing with people here, that I undoubtedly would have there. And I think almost all of it is language. Some of it is cultural, you know, so culture is not exactly the same thing as language, but it's similar, is like really being able to express myself. And so, like, I think in a lot of ways, we both probably live, this sounds terrible, like, shallow lives, you know, like in person.
All the shallowest.
And so, like, how that manifests is that, like, you know, my friends in work, or my, you know, people I podcast with hear a lot more of my real life than the people that I see on a daily basis. Now, I think that that's almost everyone in the world right now. Because even if you're one of these people that still goes into an office, like, we have friends that go to Geneva to work, they have to wear a mask all day, every day, from the minute they get out of the car till they leave the parking lot. And there is no water cooler chat. There's no happy hour. There's none of this stuff. So, like, I think that's everybody right now. But I mean, I think if I'm honest, like, on a super long term, like, the rest of my life and the rest of my kids' lives basis, that is the biggest thing I think about. It's like, is this the extent that I want to, like, kind of have connections? And that, I don't have an answer. And maybe it, you know, it gets better every year. My French gets better every year. Your Spanish probably gets better every year. And so I have more deep connections with people. Like, we went on vacation with another family last summer for like 2 weeks, and that was really so nice. Cool. Yeah, it was really so cool. Nice. And so maybe that's just kind of getting there. But yeah, I think that's if I'm super honest, that's like the thing that keeps me up at night a little.
Yeah, I understand. I really do. But I think you might get to the point where you start romanticizing what it would be like if you were back home. I've certainly made that mistake. I went back to Australia for 3 months a few years ago. Well, more than a few years ago now. And back to Melbourne, where I had spent my 20s. And it wasn't what I remembered it being. The friends I couldn't wait to spend time with are now busy with jobs and children and you know, their new friends and new interests and other things. Also, they just, turns out I've forgotten a lot of the bad things and just remembered the good things that possibly weren't there anymore.
Yeah.
And it actually helped me get that out of that mentality a lot. And I came back to Spain more appreciative of life here.
Do you, are your parents still alive in New Zealand?
Yeah, they're in New Zealand, which is why we go there. But the idea is every year to take my daughter, but COVID's put paid to that, so we're not going this year. But it's while my parents are around, that's what we'll do.
I mean, that's, for us, that's one of the kind of biggest external draws is, you know, our family is all in the States. And we try to, we haven't been back. Last Christmas we saw them. So yeah, it'll be, I don't know, another year before we can see them now, I think, which is really weird and sad. But yeah, I think that's something talking about.
When you're young and single, maybe doing a digital nomad thing, perhaps you can cope with the fact that you won't see your standard family or your parents for a while. But when you've got young children and you're more settled, that's actually something, right? To miss out on your children, miss out on that chance on regularly spending time with grandparents or the uncles and aunties or so on.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, you know, the upside, we haven't talked much about upside, is like our kids are growing up in a really great place. Like the place we live is really great, super safe, really vibrant and international. Like the scenery and the nature here and the health and mindset of the people is really great. I'm sure this exists other places, but it's not like anywhere I've lived, and I've lived in 8 different places in the US, and the place it's most similar to is San Diego, but without all the like kind of California posers, you know? Sorry for all the California people out there.
But does it have the concept of suburbs like you have in San Diego or in America, or is it more that everybody lives in smaller places in the core of the
yeah,
of the town?
Like it's more that like there are cities and there are villages on the outside of those cities.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of the same thing, I think.
When I take my daughter out for a walk, which I try to do most days, like. We see so many people in the neighborhood who know us and know her by name and interact with her. And this is a real positive thing about a child growing up here. Sure, we're a long way from the grandparents, but it's a really fun environment to be growing up in. And for her, mm-hmm. this is normal. She knows nothing else.
Yeah. 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 I mean, our kids, my daughter was 5 and my son was 3 when we moved. And so he said the other day, he's like, I don't remember, you know, the house we lived in the U.S. before we moved here. I was like, yeah, I don't expect you would. Like, it's all they've ever known. Yeah, and I think, I mean, living a long way from the grandparents is a bummer. If we didn't have this great kind of community feel that sounds like you have as well, we wouldn't have stayed. Yeah. I mean, it definitely is a two-sided coin. I think overall, we definitely are happy to be living here. It's not for the faint of heart, though, is I think the thing we're saying is like you definitely should go in eyes open and say like there are a lot of things that are really hard. There it creates this stress that, you know, folks living in their own home country don't have. But I think the upside is definitely there, too.
Yeah, I completely agree. We've made some great friends, mostly as part of our expat bubble. But whatever, the friends, we've learned to sort out the ones who are coming here for 6 months from the ones who are coming here indefinitely. Because it just gets too hard to keep making friends, and then they move away. We make friends, they move away. So now we just filter out the ones who are not intending to stay long term.
Yep.
And
that's good.
Made a big difference. So it's all about the people around you.
Like, sure, like it's that mindset.
It's like the people you work with too.
Yeah, yep. Awesome. Cool, Steve. This is really fun to catch up and really dive into this. I don't think I've ever talked this long or in depth about this. So it's cool to be able to talk to somebody who can relate to a lot of these things. And I think it's important for folks to hear if they're thinking about it. For folks who want to kind of catch up with you and learn more about kind of what you're up to, where's the best place to go?
Okay. So on Twitter, I tend to be active these days, at Steve Off McLeod. Probably have to spell that in the show notes. Saber Feedback, the product I acquired, is saberfeedback.com. And then featureupvote.com is the feature request tracking site. You can also find me at bootstrapped.fm, which is the podcast I run and it published episodes weekly.
Awesome. Steve, this is a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Craig. Bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.